Today we're in Acts chapter 28. The Apostle Paul, trying to make his way to Rome, not of his own will necessarily, though he has already said that he's very much desired to meet the Christians in Rome. He's actually on his way to Rome as a prisoner of the Roman government. As a Roman citizen, he had the right to appeal to Rome for trial. And since he had been in prison for 2 years in Caesarea, under charges from the Jewish leadership that he had somehow broken the law, and since it seemed that his trial was never either going to come to fruition in the proper place there in Caesarea, or else that he was going to be transferred back down to Jerusalem, where his life would definitely be in danger, he used his Roman citizenship to appeal his right to be transferred to Rome. That means that he was put in with a lot of other prisoners that were being transferred by the Roman government at that time to Rome for various reasons. We don't know exactly why those other prisoners might be being transferred there, but there were a number of prisoners along with him who were being moved by the Roman army to Rome, and they were being moved by ship. And we saw last week what had transpired. They were sailing in the fall of the year, which is a very treacherous time for sailing on the Mediterranean, because as the weather patterns change and the seasons are changing and therefore temperatures are different, suddenly the winds become much more erratic and they can be very violent at times. And as they had set sail, if you look at your map that was in the bulletin for today as well as last week, as they had set sail from the island of Crete, and no doubt their actual goal was to reach on that map, if you see it there, either the city of Syracuse or the port of Rhegium, which was on the southern end of the boot, which often describes the country of Italy. Just as they were setting sail, a northeaster or a very, very strong gale-like wind blowing from the northeast catches their ship. And since it's a sailing vessel, they're driven before the wind. Now normally, as I've read something about sailing vessels in the Mediterranean during the period of the Roman Empire, normally these large vessels like Paul is on, which were primarily shipping vessels for carrying grain, wine, other materials from all around the edges of the Mediterranean to the city of Rome and to the country of Italy, these large vessels, when they were at full sail, would travel at about a speed of around 4 to 5 miles per hour, or knots per hour, which isn't exactly miles per hour, but close. But that's only when the wind was right behind them and when they had the full sail. When they're trying to sail at some tack to the wind, in other words, what happens if the wind is blowing from the northeast and you're trying to sail northwest? Anyone who's ever been on a sailing vessel or know anything about that, which I know very little, it ends up meaning that they have to sort of tack in the wind and try to catch the wind and to sort of weave back and forth as they travel. That means that they end up making much slower progress. And here they are caught in a wind blowing very, very hard, gale-like wind, part of a storm that is taking them, if the wind had its way, it would actually drive them to the north coast of Africa. And so they're trying, the sailors are trying to maneuver the ship and keep it going in a more westerly direction. We will even read in our text today that at one point they were afraid that they would be beached upon the sandbars that are part of the Syrtis part of the Mediterranean. You can see that there on your map, just on the north coast of Africa to the west of Cyrene, because they didn't have the kind of navigational tools that modern men have. They hadn't yet invented the sextant, as we know it, that allowed them to know exactly where they were on the surface of the earth. Because it's a storm, they don't have a clear view of the skies at night to use the stars to guide them, which would be normally the way a sailor would know where he was going. Because it is a storm, it was probably even hard for them to tell exactly where the sun was. You could tell in general whether it was in the east, the west, and overhead. But so all in all, they were lost at sea. And as we saw at the end of last week's lesson, at the end of chapter 27, they finally are driven up on a beach. They knew they were approaching land. They've been in this storm for more than 14 days. They had given up hope until Paul, just the evening before, tells them that an angel of the Lord had spoken to him, that the God that he served had told him that their lives would be saved, but the ship would be lost, that they should take food and gain some strength because they would need it for what's about to happen. And so the ship is driven up on the eastern end of the small island of Malta, out there in the... It looks small on this map, but it's actually big if you're out there. The distance in a straight line from the place in Crete where they sailed to Malta, where they landed in a shipwreck, is a distance of 476 miles. So they've been out in open waters, not knowing exactly where they are, for more than 14 days, and they've traveled almost 500 miles. And they don't know where they are when they first hit shore. The island of Malta is quite small, only about 17 miles long, 9 miles wide at its widest point. So it's practically a speck on the ocean, and yet they're driven up on this one small piece of land. That was no accident. God is in control even in this situation. All 276 people on board the ship are saved, but the ship is lost along with all of its cargo. And now we read, starting in chapter 28, verse 1, "Once safely on shore, we found out that the island was called Malta." That's the modern name for it. You may actually be using a translation of the scriptures that uses the old name, Melita. But today it's called Malta. Small island, as I say. The place where they landed on the eastern end of the island, even today, is honored by being called St. Paul's Bay. That's what it's called in Malta today. And it really is just a beach. It's not a harbor. It is a little indention in the land right there, because that's where not even a river, a creek, comes from the interior of the island out to the sea right there. And so the land has been gradually eaten away by the flow of the waters, and that's where they were making for. But of course, they didn't make it that far before it got far too shallow, and the ship was stuck in the sandbar and gradually broken apart. But once they get on shore, they found out that the island was called Malta because it is an inhabited island. The earliest inhabitants that archaeologists have been able to find would be the Phoenician peoples. This would go back to 1,000 years before this time, or more. The Phoenicians seems to be the first ones that they found any remains of their civilization there. Later it was conquered by the Greeks and became part of their empire. Then the Carthaginians, which was a North African empire that existed for a while just to the southwest of where Malta is located there in the sea. Well, I say to the southwest, it's off to the west. You can see it on the map. Then later conquered by the Romans in their wars against the Carthaginians. They ended up conquering Malta and made it a part of the Roman Republic and now the Empire by the time we get to New Testament times. It was governed by a Roman propraetor, a governor, who answered to a superior who's located just to the north of them up on Sicily. That's where his superior officer was located. But because it was just a small place, it didn't require Roman soldiers, it didn't require that kind of thing, but it did produce some things that were of value in the Roman Empire. As I looked in the Bible dictionary, it tells us that the island was known for honey. The interior of the island did have some forest in it. Fruit, cotton, a small amount of cotton was actually raised on the island. They had some stone quarries where they took stone that was sometimes loaded on board ships and would make its way to Italy for building purposes. And it had a rather unusual breed of dog that the island was known for. You might have even heard of a Maltese. They're the small white fluffy dogs that some people like to have for house dogs. They come from this island originally. And so they learned that the island was called Malta. Verse 2, the islanders, it says in the NIV, kind of interesting that like the King James and some of the others, we'll actually put more literally what it says in the Greek language there. It says, the barbarous people. Now, we think of barbarians as people who are wild, militant kind of folks, like the Huns or some of the Germanic tribes that the Romans had to fight against during the days of the Roman Empire. But actually, in the Greek language, barbarian did not mean wild or uncivilized. It simply meant someone who spoke a language other than Greek or Latin. And so these non-Greek, non-Latin speaking people of the island, that's literally what it means. And the real word in Greek, barbar, comes from the fact that that's what it sounded like when a person who only knew Greek or Latin heard these people speaking. They were making sounds, but they didn't understand what they meant. And so barbar is how they sort of originally mocked people who didn't speak their language. And later it became a part of their vocabulary to describe people who were not Greek or Latin speakers. And so these non-Greek or Latin speaking people, they were described as barbarians. So they were the islanders. So the islanders, Luke says, showed us unusual kindness. There was one small port on the island. It was on the western end, and they had crash landed on the east end. And the people of Malta did not have nearly as many visitors, and especially such a large number all at once as this ship afforded them. But Luke makes note of the fact that they were extremely kind people. And we'll see more of that as the story develops here. They built a fire and welcomed us all because it was raining and cold. By this time, it's probably November of the year. They've been in this storm for 14 days with the rain and the wind and everything. And it's still going on, but they've just now crashed on this shore. And so the people are trying to help them be more comfortable. And perhaps there's some kind of shelters there, and they're building a fire for them under it. And it says, Paul gathered a pile of brushwood. So Paul's helping. He's doing his part. Paul gathered a pile of brushwood, and as he put it on the fire, a viper, a poisonous snake, driven out by the heat, fastened itself on his hand. So he's bitten by a poisonous snake. When the islanders saw the snake hanging from his hand, they said to each other, "This man must be a murderer, for though he escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." They knew that anyone bitten by this serpent would almost surely die. And they're somewhat superstitious, and this was common in that day and time, to believe that the fates, as they're called, these supernatural beings that they imagined existed, would make sure that justice was served. And they know Paul's one of the prisoners that's come off the ship, and so they assume, since he's been bitten by this poisonous snake, that this was the God's way of making sure justice is served. He didn't die at sea, so he's going to die now. But there's another story at work here also, isn't it? Isn't it interesting that even as Jesus was telling his disciples shortly before he left this earth to go back to heaven, he told them in Mark chapter 16, in verse 15, he said to them, "Go into all the world and preach the good news to all creation." And that's what Paul's doing. "Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned. And these signs will accompany those who believe. In my name they will drive out demons. They will speak in new tongues. They will pick up snakes with their hands. And when they drink deadly poison, it will not hurt them at all. And they will place their hands on sick people, and they will get well." So Jesus said miraculous things would accompany these earlier messengers of the gospel. And here is such a messenger. And while the islanders expect him to drop dead from the poison of the snake, and Paul isn't saying that won't happen, he also knows that the Lord also said that when they are about his business, that they would be protected from these things. But it says, Paul shook the snake off his hand into the fire and suffered no ill effects. Don't you know, everybody watched him for a good long while, keep waiting for the inevitable to happen, and it never happened. The people expected him to swell up or suddenly fall over dead, but after waiting a long time and seeing nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and said he was a god. What an opportunity for Paul. He has their undivided attention right now. It says there was an estate nearby that belonged to Publius, the chief official of the island. This is the proprietor or the governor. He welcomed us to his home. Luke says us, so that would mean at least Luke and Paul and probably their small group. I kind of suspect he didn't invite the entire 276 people. Because surely in that group, not just of prisoners, but other travelers and the owner of the ship, the pilot, soldiers and so forth, there were many that the governor wouldn't have any interest in. But perhaps because Paul's been bitten and doesn't die from the serpent's bite, and he's also a Roman citizen, maybe he hears from Julius, a centurion who's accompanying them and guarding them about Paul. He's actually this select group are invited up to Publius's estate. He welcomed us to his home and for 3 days entertained us hospitably. His father was sick in bed, suffering from fever and dysentery. Paul went in to see him and after prayer placed his hands on him and healed him. See what Paul is doing? He's playing out exactly the thing Jesus said would happen, that would accompany those who were the first preachers of the gospel message. Paul didn't arrange to have the serpent bite him, but when it did, it didn't harm him. And now, when he's presented with the opportunity to bring healing to someone in the name of Jesus, this man's father is healed. And then it says, when this had happened, the rest of the sick on the island came and were cured. And so the word spreads quickly, not only about Paul's not dying from the snake bite, but also of healing Publius's father. And so everybody on the island shows up who needs healing. And it says they were cured. And then Luke says they honored us in many ways. And when we were ready to sail, they furnished us with the supplies we needed. So they were hospitable to start with. And now, as they're blessed by the effects of the gospel, even if all of them didn't necessarily respond to the gospel message itself, they're even more hospitable in their care for these castaways on their shore. And it says, then after 3 months, we put out to sea in a ship that had wintered in the island. It was an Alexandrian ship. Now, the one they had been shipwrecked on was an Alexandrian ship, because these were the ships that were carrying the great loads of grain from Egypt up to Rome. And here's another one that it managed to get to the island and had wintered there in the port on the western shore. And it was an Alexandrian ship with a figurehead of the twin gods Castor and Pollux. Many of the ships, maybe all the ships of that time that were seagoing vessels, would have a statue of one or another of the Greek or the Roman gods mounted on their bow as a way of trying to solicit the blessing of the deities on them as they sailed. And we've already seen from the story, as well as knowing from archaeology, that there's untold hundreds, maybe thousands of vessels sunk in the Mediterranean, and they occasionally find them even now, all from this period of time. And while most of the ships made their ports, inevitably a certain number didn't every year. And so they would always be beseeching the blessing of the gods that they might have a safe journey. And here's this ship here. And so again, consulting our map, it says, we put in at Syracuse. And so as they left the island of Malta, they sailed north, more or less up to the port of Syracuse, the main city of Sicily in that period of time. That was a distance of about 80 miles to the north. And then it says from there they stayed 3 days, possibly waiting for favorable winds to continue on, or maybe taking on more supplies. We don't know for sure. After the ship had spent 3 months in Malta, you see, they would have pretty much depleted their own ship's supplies of food and things like that. And Malta wasn't a large enough island to really supply all that much to that many vessels, being as small as it was. So perhaps they took on extra supplies now at Syracuse. And then it says, from there we set sail and arrived at Rhegium. Rhegium was at the opening of this, a little inlet, well, that's not the right word, I don't know, the sort of an isthmus, this little opening in between the end of Italy and the northern part of Sicily. You can see on your map there that it's just a little opening that they had to pass through that would get them into the Tyrrhenian Sea and allow them to continue on up now the western coast of Italy. And so they arrived at Rhegium. The next day, the south wind came up. That's what they were waiting on, a wind that would carry them north, because it's blowing from the south. So the south wind came up, and on the following day, we reached Puteoli. Well, that's quite a distance. I understand that from Rhegium to Puteoli is about 180 miles by sea. And so in a time of a little more than 24 hours, but less than 48, they travel 180 miles. The ship's making good time when the wind's behind them and it's blowing strong. If you calculate about 5 miles per hour in about 36 hours, that'll give you 180 miles. So they made good time to get from Rhegium on up to Puteoli. Puteoli is important because this is the nearest port to Rome that could take these large vessels in. The port that is located very near Rome, even today, isn't able to take on large vessels. And so Puteoli was the largest port on the western shore of Italy for taking in large vessels like this. So they would put in here dozens of them every day and would be unloaded at the port there. And all the wheat, the oil, the wine, whatever else it was that they're carrying, and passengers and prisoners and soldiers and so forth would get off at Puteoli. And then they would travel by land from there up to Rome. And so now they've made it as far as Puteoli. There we found some brothers. We don't know how they found them. Since they've started this journey and left, actually, the eastern end of the Mediterranean, this is the first mention of them actually encountering other Christians. But they find in Puteoli Christians. How they were able to identify each other and make contact, we don't know. But this is going to become important in a hurry. And it says, there we found some brothers who invited us to spend a week with them. Apparently this was with the agreement of Julius the centurion that he would let Paul have this week. Why a week? Well, earlier in the story, like back in Acts chapter 20 and several other places as well during this time in Paul's life, we find that he would often, when he'd get to a city and find Christians there, he would stay long enough to be there over Sunday. And why would he be doing that? Because that allowed him not only to see the Christians there individually, the ones he had come in contact with, but that was the time when Christians from the very beginning met together as a group, like we're doing here this morning. And so he stays over 7 days with them. This guarantees that he had the time to spend a Sunday with them and be with the church in assembly and probably spoke to them and celebrated the Lord's Supper with them like we've done this morning. Now there's one small hitch in all of this. Paul is doing all of this with a soldier chained to his wrist. That's a little inconvenience, don't you think? Y'all might think it strange if I were standing up here this morning and there's a chain attached to my right wrist and standing here right next to me, just within 3 or 4 feet of me, would be a policeman. And yet that's the kind of situation Paul is in now. But we don't hear him complaining about that. He's grateful that he has this opportunity. And so they stay a week with them. And then he says, and so we went to Rome. Well, while he's in Puteoli this week, somebody, it has to be, from Puteoli, one of the Christians there, travels all the way to Rome. That's quite a challenge. That's a distance of almost 100 miles up there. So that's going to take him 4 or 5 days to get up there, especially if he's walking. Perhaps he had a horse or something like that. But somebody from Puteoli, without us being told that it happened, we know this had to happen, travels from Puteoli all the way up to Rome, and what does he do? He finds the Christians up in Rome and says, Paul is coming. How do they know who Paul is? Because Paul had written them a letter 4 years before called the Epistle to the Romans in our Bible and had sent it to the church in Rome and told them he was looking forward to the day when he could come and visit them. And he had written this great, great book, as we call it, letter actually, explaining what the gospel is all about and how we're saved and how this was God's great plan for us. And apparently it had a tremendous impact on the church in Rome. And so when someone comes from Puteoli and says, Paul is a prisoner down in Puteoli right now, but he's coming this way, there's an immediate positive response on the part of the Christians in Rome. For it says, and so we went to Rome. In verse 15, the brothers there had heard that we were coming. They couldn't call them on a cell phone or a telephone. They didn't send them a letter. It wouldn't have gotten there any faster than a person walking. The only way they could get this message was by someone actually having come and told them. The brothers there had heard that we were coming, and they traveled as far as the Forum of Appius and the three taverns, or the three inns, to meet us. And if you look on your map, again, that's just about once someone traveled from Puteoli up to Rome. Remember, he had 7 days to get this done in, because that's how long Paul's going to stay in Puteoli. And then for the brethren up there to immediately respond, and some to start making their way back down the road towards Paul, it's about the time they get to the three taverns and the Forum of Appius that Paul and Luke and his group, as they're traveling north with the soldiers and all, meet the Christians coming the other way looking for them. And as little as this story is, Luke wants us to know this is happening, and it should be something that's extremely heartwarming for us. And we know it was heartwarming for Paul. But this is the only clear indication we have of how his letter was actually received by the Christians in Rome and what effect it had on them. And at the sight of these men, Paul thanked God and was encouraged. And when we got to Rome, Paul was allowed to live by himself with a soldier to guard him. So they finally made it to Rome. Not in the way he wished, but if we actually are reading in the King James and some of the other translations, there's a little, shall we call it a glitch in the manuscripts at this place in the book of Acts. We know that we have hundreds of copies of the New Testament, including the book of Acts, that have come down to us from the first few centuries after it was written. And there is here, in verse 16, in some of the manuscripts, an additional little bit of information that others don't have. For it says there in verse 16, and the King James Version, if you're using that, reflects this, it says that that the centurion delivered the prisoners to the captain of the guard. And Paul was allowed to live by himself with a soldier to guard him. There was a large camp just to the south of the city of Rome proper. There was a military camp. And it's where the Praetorian Guard, the personal bodyguard of the emperor himself, were stationed. And one of their responsibilities was to be the checkpoint where prisoners were checked in who were there for eventual justice in Rome. And they maintained for lack of a better word, a prison facility, a jail there for these. And this would involve hundreds and thousands of people over time. And this is where the centurion goes with Paul. And later Paul will identify someone else in their party by the name of Aristarchus, who's also a prisoner. Paul calls him my fellow prisoner. But this is also apparently where Luke and the others who were not prisoners but was accompanying Paul would all have gone. And Paul is showing been shown a special favor. We're not exactly sure why. Some have speculated that perhaps Julius, the centurion, who's been with him all the way from Caesarea, actually had instructions from Festus, the governor, to give Paul special privileges. Others think that maybe just Julius on his own, having become so impressed by Paul after this long journey together and learning more and more about him and the gospel, on his own used his authority to say that Paul didn't have to stay in the prison with all the others. Because after all, Festus and Agrippa both have already said Paul's not guilty of the charges that he's here to face. And so he's actually allowed to have a small rented house or apartment or something that he can stay in. And we'll be able to talk next week about where did Paul get the money to pay for that. But he does, because of the legal system, does have to stay chained to this soldier. And when I say soldier, it probably wasn't just one. There were probably men who knows, maybe they served 24-hour shifts being attached to Paul, and then they'd be relieved by someone else who would take their place. But probably over time, it was mostly the same men over and over. And we'd think about what an intolerable situation that was, but we'll see next week when we read the book of Philippians that Paul writes while he's in Rome in this situation. He actually talks about how some of these men have become Christians. After all, they can't get away from him, and Paul can't stop talking, so either they're going to become some of the staunchest enemies of the faith, or they're going to be converted by it. 3 days later, he called together the leaders of the Jews. Paul is going to now go ahead and be proactive and meet with the Jewish leaders who lived in Rome. There's about 60,000, historians tell us, about 60,000 Jews lived in Rome, a city of over 1 million people. And they had at least 7 different synagogues, maybe more in the city. And Paul, after 3 days, asked to meet with the leaders of the Jews. And when they had assembled, Paul said to them, "My brothers, although I have done nothing against our people or against the customs of our ancestors, I was arrested in Jerusalem and handed over to the Romans. They examined me and wanted to release me because I was not guilty of any crime deserving death. But when the Jews objected, I was compelled to appeal to Caesar, not that I had any charge to bring against my own people. For this reason, I have asked to see you and talk with you. It is because of the hope of Israel that I am bound with this chain." So Paul's been very proactive in meeting with the Jewish leadership and says, look, this is why I'm here. Our leaders back in Jerusalem wanted to have me executed for something I was not guilty of, and so I've been sent here. But he also sort of leaves the door open to say, and I'm actually here because of the hope of Israel. This was a very Jewish term that was a way of talking about the gospel. And they replied, "We have not received any letters from Judea concerning you, and none of the brothers who has come from there has reported or said anything bad about you." So while the Christians were glad to see Paul, the Jews themselves had not even got any information that Paul was on his way. This is also helps explain why Paul will end up being under house arrest in Rome for 2 years. Once he finally gets there in the system, the judicial system, finds out why he's here, they will then say, okay, where are your accusers? You see, Paul really put them at a great disadvantage too. And when there's no one from the Jewish leadership here to accuse Paul, a message has to go all the way back to Rome and demand that they send those who are accusing Paul. And then they have to travel all the way back to Rome to be there for the court hearing. That's all going to take months and months, maybe well over a year. And then on top of that, you have to get your court docket, you know, the time set for the court. And so Paul's going to be here for 2 years. But they're going to eventually show up. They're going to be called by the Roman justice system to be there to face him. But they said, "We haven't yet even heard anything concerning you, and none of the people who have come from Jerusalem so far has reported or said anything bad about you, but we want to hear what your views are, for we know that people everywhere are talking against this sect." I might even use the word cult. So the Jewish leadership knows there's Christians in Rome, and they've already been meeting and conflicting with them, and so they want to hear what Paul has to say about this whole thing. This, I think, indicates that no one with any kind of authority, like any other apostle, has yet been to Rome for the gospel to be preached in on that level to the people in Rome. There were people from Rome on the day of Pentecost, all the way back in Acts chapter 2. They've come back, and the gospel is spread in Rome because of them. We know later when Paul will meet Priscilla and Aquila, they had come from Rome and apparently had become Christians while there. And now, later, are probably back here again. But no apostle, no leading evangelist of the gospel, like Mark or others, have yet made it to Rome to preach the gospel. Paul is the first one. And so these men say, Jewish as they are, said, "We want to hear from you what your views are." And so they arranged to meet Paul on a certain day and came in even larger numbers to the place where he was staying. He can't go where they are. He is under house arrest. So they come where he is. And from morning till evening, he explained and declared to them the kingdom of God and tried to convince them about Jesus from the law of Moses and from the prophets. So he gives them everything he's got in one day, from morning to evening. Some were convinced by what he said, but others would not believe. They disagreed among themselves and began to leave after Paul had made this final statement. The Holy Spirit spoke the truth to your forefathers when he said through Isaiah the prophet, go to this people and say, what Paul is saying, said back in the days of Isaiah, this is what happened. Isaiah was trying to warn the Jewish people of his day about what God was doing, and most of them wouldn't listen. Said, now that's happening again in your day. Because Isaiah said, go to this people and say, you will be ever hearing but never understanding. You will be ever seeing but never perceiving. For this people's heart has become calloused. Some of you have to work hard. I don't. I mean, I work, but I don't have any calluses on my hand. I come near having calluses on my fingertips from having to type on a computer all day long, but some of you know what it is to have calluses. These people have calloused hearts. They hardly hear with their ears, and they have closed their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn. And God says, and I would heal them. Therefore, Paul says, I want you to know that God's salvation has been sent to the Gentiles, and they will listen. Paul wants the Jewish people to know that God had said through Isaiah and others that the gospel was not just for the Jews, it was for the Gentiles as well. And while the Jews are not receiving it in large numbers, many fit the category of what Isaiah says here, the Gentiles were. So this is actually Paul's explanation to them of why this group existed already in Rome that were Christians and why most of them were Gentiles, not Jews. They had asked him to explain to them more about this. He just has. And so Luke closes his story for us by saying, for 2 whole years, Paul stayed there in his own rented house and welcomed all who came to see him. Boldly and without hindrance, he preached the kingdom of God and taught about the Lord Jesus. So even though he's chained to a soldier and limited to his house, he does what he loves to do. You see, Paul had found his life purpose. A very popular book written by a man I've actually had the privilege to meet, not that that means anything, but called The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren. Been a bestseller for a long time on the New York Times bestseller list. Paul had a purpose-driven life, and his purpose was to make known to everyone possible the story about Jesus so they might possibly be saved. What Luke has just told us and wrapped up here at the end is that while it might not have been Paul's plan to go to Rome as a prisoner, it was God's plan. Everything that's happened in the book of Acts has been God's plan. Paul, that few years earlier when he had written to the Christians in Rome, had told them in Romans chapter 8, for we know that in all things God works for the good of those that love Him, to those who are called according to His purpose. God didn't make these things necessarily happen to Paul, but God worked in all these things for His purposes to be accomplished. And as a result, much good was done. We don't know ultimately how much influence Paul had on Julius the centurion and the other soldiers that accompanied him, on these soldiers here at the Praetorian Guard headquarters where Paul is for 2 years, even though he will say later that the gospel has been heard throughout the Praetorian Guard. We don't know how much good he did on the island of Malta, the 3 months he was there, as he was first able to demonstrate to people that God was with him as he was protected by being bitten by the serpent and then later by healing so many on the island. We have to believe that possibly this was the gospel coming to Malta. And while Paul is here and sort of stationary, so he, in addition to preaching and teaching and influencing other people, has the time to also sit down and write some letters that we might recognize. The letter to the Philippians, the letter to the Ephesians, the letter to the Colossians, the little very short letter to the man named Philemon, all of them in our New Testament. Paul writes them during this time. Much good is done while he's here. And most of all, as Paul would say, in all things Christ is glorified. You know, our life is much the same way. Sometimes we think it's all laid out before us exactly what we're going to do and what's going to happen, and then it doesn't turn out that way. What we really need to be concerned about at times like that is not our security and what the future holds, but rather, are we still operating within God's plan in all of this? Am I still doing God's will? And will Christ be glorified in all of this? What good will come, even out of bad circumstances? We'll talk about what happens to Paul after this. Luke closes his book. We don't have Luke anymore to tell us what happens to Paul after this. But we still know some things that did happen, and we'll be looking at those next week.